Hey everyone, thanks for listening to an episode of the Matt Rich Podcast. I am here today with a special guest, Dr. Loftus. How are you doing today?
I'm very good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for joining me. It's good to have you on. So, tell us, the listeners a little about yourself.
Well, I'm partially retired. I've been teaching at Purdue Northwest for 11 years. And my previous occupations, I've served in the military, been a musician, among other things, and my background that prepared me to be at Purdue at this point in life included my bachelor's degree in art and theology, a master of divinity degree, an earned PhD, and an honorary THD. I love motorcycles, traveling, reading, cooking, and play guitar every once in a while. And I'm actually trying to master Russian language.
Wow.
And hope to complete some ESL training this next year. So it's a busy life at this point when you're retired.
Yeah.
Or supposed to be.
Seems like you are a pursuer of knowledge.
Yes, it either pursued me or I pursued it. I'm still trying to figure that out, who did it first. You know?
So do you have out of all the things that you've studied, do you have any favorites, one that you lean towards? Because right now how I ran into you, you were a philosophy professor at Purdue.
Right.
And
yeah.
Right now is that what you're currently doing besides studying Russian?
Right. Yeah. As far as teaching, yeah, that's my main focus, either in moral philosophy or classic philosophy. So the classes will either be geared towards introductions to ethics. And then there's another course that's offered called Ethics for the Professions, which is geared more into specific occupations like doctors, engineers, etc.
Yeah, before I took your course, I didn't know, I didn't realize such importance of what ethics was and how, you know, it influences the way society runs and
right.
How important it really is for everybody to, the way we interact with each other. For the people who haven't really taken a philosophy course, what do you call philosophy? What is philosophy to you?
Well, to me, it's really just a method or a framework, if you will, and it orders your thinking about common, larger ideas. Think of it this way. We all carry the world in our hands with our cell phones, but there are very few people who can carry a world of ideas in their mind. We all want this pocket-sized understanding of ourselves and the world we live in, and it makes us feel more in control. And so what philosophy does, it's almost like the cell phone in a sense. It shrinks the world, kind of takes the edges off of feeling isolated and practically invisible. And really a phone can't really do that as an idea, but philosophy can, because it connects you to this pattern of thinking that's been around for 3,000 to 4,000 years. So that's how I see it. But you know, if there's someone who doesn't know anything of the topic, the word philosophy will probably sound like someone on Earth trying to listen to a radio signal from another galaxy. And the world may be there or it may not be. So that's one way to look at it. But to me, I tell people, look at it this way. Not only were the philosophers good with ideas, but a lot of the early ones were very skilled in the things that people today think are more practical. Math, science, engineering. Yeah. And they let their minds go beyond the material boundaries. And so to me, that's what philosophy can do.
Okay. So what did the world, what did society and what did civilization look like before philosophy? Where did philosophy, was that where like reasonable, like rational thinking and all these things came in? Like, do we start looking at the world differently because of philosophy, or was philosophy the name we, like, was that the term coined because we were already looking at that world differently?
Like, I think that was, well, to be, I mean, look at it this way. I think it's more a descriptor of what people were doing. They wanted it to be a more scientific enterprise by the time the word philosophy was used, because if you look at it from a purely historical viewpoint, there were the pre-Socratic philosophers who were not considered the genuine philosophers. So they weren't necessarily considered people who would order it into a pattern of thinking. But by the time you get to the big names like Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, now we have this fully developed. And now we have an ordered system. And thereafter, that's the way it goes. But in the meantime, it's more like a method or an investigative process of thinking.
Yeah, and it's like they're kind of coining terms and stuff for things that we almost naturally do, which is really interesting, the way that you learn about reason and even skepticism. That was a really interesting topic that stood out to me as well, just because we all have that innate, you know, instinctive skepticism inside of us all, but before that was really, you know, talked about and focused
on. There's certainly a lot of room for doubt in the world, and that plays well at times, and other times it certainly doesn't work for you. So yeah, it's a very interesting point when we get to talking about ideas that really influence people.
Yeah. So what influenced you into philosophy?
Wow. You know, thinking about that takes me back to a time when I thought I was pursuing another career in art. When I got out of the military, I had a scholarship to Kansas City Art Institute. And one of my first courses was Western civilization. And so really that was sort of the genesis moment of finding out about some of the big ideas that I teach now. That's when they were new to me. And so that's when I started reading the life of Siddhartha, Marx, and a lot of other big names. And so I started taking more courses in philosophy, more courses in Western and Eastern religions while finishing university at a later point. And this just kept going into my doctorate studies. So by the time I got more exposed to classical philosophers and comparing them to traditional theologians and religious beliefs, I'd pretty much covered the waterfront about a 20-year period. So by then I had really gotten more invested mentally, if you will, in the subject. And I noticed what was really interesting to me that a lot of people may not think about, but I see it more as I teach, is that the religious ideas and the philosophical ideas aren't always separate. They tend to overlap at points because similar questions get asked in both areas. So I tell people, this is a good example. Take a motif or a symbol like the tree of life. It's very common in Eastern and Western philosophical and religious thought. You can see it with Aristotle in his ethics, and he talks about people flourishing like trees, but so did wisdom literature under King Solomon. It said the same thing at an earlier point than Aristotle. So in a sense, that's what kind of draws me into the field and keeps me there, because these things keep overlapping and I see the patterns, and it's always interesting to me that way.
And what are these patterns reoccurring themes throughout history and different cultures? So they're coming in, are you saying they're coming to the same conclusions in a sense?
I don't know if they're always coming to the same conclusions, but it's like eventually everyone asks very similar questions, or they see mentally and visually similar ideas. And so it doesn't mean they're necessarily 100% the same, but you can see patterns between the natural philosophies, for example. If you look at Lao Tzu, and he talks about the way, and he's given the credit as being the founder of Taoism. And if we look at that in the Western half, we find that in a few philosophers, but probably not where we expect. We actually find something like that in a religious philosopher like Thomas Aquinas. And we would never equate him with Taoism in terms of fundamental beliefs, but yet they both placed an emphasis on something natural in terms of knowledge. And to me, that's where the organic overlap happens, even if they go in different directions. So I think it's very fascinating.
It is. So I know one of the major themes that societies or philosophers question is, I would assume, existence and our purpose here on the planet. And why do you think human beings are all in that kind of question? Is there more place here? And we naturally have that question. We want a hole to fill.
Yeah, I think really, to be honest, I think it's because people generally tend to ask and question a lot of sense. Really, to me, it explains why philosophy is appealing, because it can actually mold the thoughts that people have. And I like to see it this way. Thinking is like an economy of its own. So all the best thoughts and ideas should be seen as valuable, but the supply is often lacking versus the demand. So we need quality thinking about our ideas. We need that in any age, any century. So to me, that's why it's important. And I think that's the appeal to people. They're trying to actually have some kind of a mental framework or stability of understanding. And really, the thing that I've learned lately is that philosophy can actually be more of a global pursuit than it probably was even a couple of thousand years ago. One philosopher in the West may or may not have known about a philosopher in the East. Yeah. Some did, many didn't. And now from the position of hindsight, we can go back and see, oh, okay, this is why this philosopher was thinking a very similar thought, because the world was getting more connected during that time.
Mm, interesting.
And so that's what's going on now. So when I look back, I try to see the parallels across the centuries.
Yeah, I like seeing the dots connected and what influenced what. And it's very interesting to see where, just naturally, where the human psyche and where our philosophies go in different cultures. Now, what do you think the importance of is with philosophy?
Well, I guess it goes back partly to what I just said about it being an economy, and there's this human need to know.
Yeah.
And it's like,
I'm cursed with that as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's everyone has this inquisitive side, and some people obviously more so than others. And it's really more of like a thirst, if you will.
Yeah.
And some people, they're just more thirsty than others. Mm-hmm. And the people, I think, that think there's more, want to know more, they pursue it more. I tell my philosophy class, it's like Columbus. And when he left Spain, the common view was no more beyond, because of the belief in how the world was shaped. And when he came back, they literally had to change the words on the statue to there is more beyond. They had to change their minds. Wow. After someone took the risk for the sake of knowing. And wow. So that to me just typifies what philosophy does. Are you taking the risk of knowing?
Yeah, it's so fascinating to me that we are these questioning creatures. And what seems like the only ones in the known universe, mm-hmm. that question what is, you know, what is out at sea, to the point where we build ships to sail out there and risk our lives, like what Columbus did. Like, why? That's so fascinating to me that we are the only creatures that display that.
Right.
And it could get to the point where, you know, we are controlling atoms and splitting atoms and, you know, exploring the universe. It's crazy to think about where this is. It philosophy, or is it just this power of questioning can bring us?
Well, I think it goes down into a question we'll probably talk about in a little bit, which is more about, you know, the idea of what life is about, you know, in philosophy, how I would approach that. I think that really answers it more, because obviously we know that there's more in our existence than just us. Sort of like with ethics, we know that the government wants something from us. our neighbor, they all expect something out of us. Well, we expect something out of reality in philosophy. And so I think that answers your question. We're trying to find out what that is through
So what philosophy do you find yourself thinking about or contemplating a lot? Is there one that kind of stands out to you?
Well, I've kind of alluded to it, but it's really a two-way tie. And it's really between Plato's idea of the cave allegory and natural law. They really break down the subject of knowledge and knowing, or epistemology, as they say in philosophy. See, I like it how Plato explains the process of knowing, while Aquinas speaks of self-evident truth being known. And to me, when you can compare two philosophers who seem to be coming at the same subject from different ways, that to me is how you can appreciate the dimensions of philosophy. I mean, it's one way to consider the subject of knowledge. I mean, people always want to know, how do we even unlearn what isn't to be learned or is wrong, and what things can we not know? In other words, what's impossible for people not to be aware of? You know, so it's like holding up a jewel and looking at all the different sides of the cuts, and the more you examine, the more light goes through the jewel. So that's what philosophy should do for you, and that's what you should be thinking about, whichever your flavor of philosophy might be.
Interesting. Yeah, that I like the cave allegory one as well. That one, I think it kind of is such a mind trip that it makes you really think about all the, like what you kind of said, all the stuff you really don't know and what you're presented as truth just because you've been indoctrinated into it since you were kind of born. But it does make you think about, it gives that idea of questioning, of just kind of skepticism and questioning what you're presented.
It's really what a lot of people, and I covered this in my introductory class on philosophy, but it's very interesting. And off the top of my head, I cannot remember the man's name. I can remember it was a NASA engineer or scientist who coined the term logometrics. And it's basically the study of dark and light and how it keys into physics and engineering. But it actually sounds very similar to what Plato talks about in the cave allegory, coming out of the dark into the light. So to me, I think we're always just repeating some of these things. It could sound more technical, it could sound more scientific, or it can be very much a picture versus a word thing. But we're doing it constantly.
Yeah, we are. It's kind of in everyday stuff. That's interesting the way that's put. So as a philosopher, have you ever come up with any philosophical like questions that you may have like pondered or have some that?
Well, in a way, I tell myself I'm not sure I can come up with any new questions, but in a way I think, to me, this is what I would do if I had the ability to get it done. I don't know if anybody could, but it would be very interesting.
Sorry about the confusion, everyone. The camera went out, so we're going to switch it back to my webcam camera and continue the conversation from here. Okay, so continuing from what I was asking, I asked you if you had any philosophical questions or any ideas that you came up with or have that you ponder yourself.
Sure. In a way, I don't think I could ask new questions, but to me, it would be very interesting if you could sit down with well-known leaders or even celebrities and ask the questions to them that the philosophers asked themselves. Kind of like Socrates did with the concept of the dialectic. I'm curious to see what ideas influence the people who want to influence the rest of us.
That's a very
I don't think we're asking them enough, and yet we're paying them millions of dollars. We're buying their music, seeing their movies, etc. And in the end, they're people too. So what idea is getting them out of bed every day and pushing to be, you know, an influencer or just be famous, you know?
That's a very scary thought when you think about it.
It can be.
Yeah. They get kind of.
They might be. A lot of
why society looks the way it does, right?
Yeah, you would probably really get some surprises, I would think.
Wow. Yeah.
But nobody thinks about but it is a bona fide question, and students in ethics classes, I think. Think about this a little more than pure philosophical classes do, because ethics are more action oriented, and so they're not just something on the wall that you say you do or don't do. And I think, yeah, you have to ask yourself, man, who's influencing me and what's going on behind their eyes that I don't know?
Yeah, that is a very good question, because what you said, these ethics are actions, and these are influence people's actions in the world. And I feel like a lot of people's morals nowadays are coming from either other celebrities with no grounded morals in anything, or like, yeah, you're right. It's all like produced by fake, social media stuff.
Yeah. They're very much on a low moral fiber diet, I think, in terms of ethics. And I think a lot of people are beginning to question these things, because if you look at what people are paid to influence and push products, that everybody really isn't qualified to be doing what looks like entertainment, which it's really not. It's part of business, but it's become so close to entertainment, most people can't tell the difference.
Yeah, that is very true. And at this point, we have basically algorithms that are kind of doing the work for us and pushing certain things.
They're more in control of your life than you think.
yeah, they're kind of influencing the morals. They're doing our moral thing for us.
They control more than I think people realize.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a problem we're going to see in the future that we haven't even near seen the effects of yet.
Yeah.
Now, are there any philosophical ideas that are your favorite ones? I know we kind of briefly talked about what you were talking about, the cave allegory and stuff, but are there ones like from maybe specific philosophers that you would possibly think that maybe made really big influences in history? I think all of them kind of did.
Yeah, I know you're breaking up a little bit again. I don't know. Hopefully you can hear me well. But what I think is interesting is how the public or the general world, if you will, how often little bits of philosophy are floating around in pop culture. You can hear so many things and not realize you're hearing philosophy ideas and how people are using them or reacting to them.
Yeah.
So when I see, for example, painting or hear music, and I hear something philosophical in it, it catches my attention, because the song Dust in the Wind is very much influenced by Buddhism. You can see the dread of Kierkegaard in the famous painting The Scream. So what I do is I say, okay, I wonder how people could reduce something like Gandhi's "Be the change you want to see in the world" down to a bumper stick, more than that to them. It'd be very interesting to discuss a lot of these popular quotes of philosophers that get repeated out of context, or even the ones that get quoted, but they're incomplete. And I'll give you an example. This is a very common one. Socrates, but that's not the complete quote, but that's where everybody stops. The original statement is actually a little darker than that. Maybe this is why they don't quote it. He said, "Know thyself, mortal." The depth of introspection everyone may expect, but it does say a lot more. One word says a lot more than if you take it away. So favorite ideas, I try to look at context and...
Okay, sorry, continue.
Yeah, I was just saying that as far as favorite ideas to discuss or think about, to me, it's just simply about looking at the context that very well-known philosophical statements were made in, because a lot of them, as I said, they float around in pop culture, but most people don't know the context or even the complete quotes of these individuals. And so to me, once you do, you open up a lot more knowledge and meaning than previously they made them known.
Interesting. Yeah, it's kind of weaved into our just our culture now, and many people don't know where it originated, but it's interesting to figure that out. And especially if you can see it, it's kind of like seeing that hidden secret within everything that influences it, you know?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. As a philosopher, and reading and absorbing all this different information that you've, you know, got stored up there, what would you, if you had to conclude a purpose of life out of all these people who chase this answer,
Do I have something? Yeah, I think it's rather interesting because in the class on philosophy, that comes near the end of the course, and it's always interesting to see what students say to me about that, because 90% of the time you ask them what is the meaning of life, and they're like hoping I'm going to tell them. And I think, okay, I have this, but okay, it may not be what everybody has, but this is kind of evolved in a way for me. It's not necessarily changed over the years as much as it's just gotten more full as a statement. So I'll explain it this way. It wasn't very long ago, I read a poem that actually filled in a big blank for me and gave me some insight here. It's a poem called The Buried Life by a man named Matthew Arnold. And it's actually the poem that inspired the term the bucket list. And everybody talks about that. Before you die, make sure you do your bucket list, right?
Yeah.
And what the poem actually does is it reminds us that putting your purpose, your dreams, your hopes, your desires all in the ground before you are put there makes no sense at all. And yet people do it all the time. So the purpose or the meaning of life seems very elusive because people are burying it under a lot of expressions or technology or fear. They say things like, live like you were dying when they're in perfect health. Mm. But it doesn't answer the fundamental question that people really want to know, which is, am I existing for a reason, and what is it? That's generally what people are asking when they ask the question. And so to say what it is, well, to me, life means to simply live in every sense of the word. I mean, you're already doing it for some reason at this point. Just be sure to do it intentionally, mindfully, fearlessly, passionately, and have the right purpose. And to me, that's it.
Interesting. So you're not necessarily looking at it like we have a reason that we're here. You look at it as life's purpose is just to live.
Well, yeah, you're here, and the reasons for it hopefully are the things you're doing.
Interesting.
In other words, you're not just existing, but you're putting into life what you're getting out of it. And even more, I would think, if you're really benefiting. So I guess that depends. Maybe if you aren't getting enough out of it, maybe you feel you can't put more in or shouldn't have to. I don't know. Depends on the person. But I would think that would affect people's meaning right there.
Yeah, for sure. So what benefits do you think philosophy has done for you, and what do you think it could do for others?
Well, there's several things I could put into that. Certainly, as I just mentioned a moment ago, with Socrates, the idea of introspection, I think that's lacking quite a bit today. And it's very philosophical, and people actually do it without realizing that's a philosophical technique. It's been around since, well, like I said, at least Socrates, if not earlier. So I think the influence of Hume and skepticism is another great example of how influential philosophy can be without people realizing it, especially Hume, and you look at crime and punishment. I know in the ethics class and in the philosophy class, I mentioned his Prisoner's Dilemma. It's a great example of what's used in the justice system, because it's a technique you see in a lot of movies where good cop, bad cop, and they do that against two suspects to try to get each to incriminate each other. Well, that's basically the Prisoner's Dilemma. Who's going to crack first? Who's going to get their weakness exploited, their fear exploited first? And so that's one part. The other side is how skepticism can actually be a benefit. Courts tell juries all the time, use reasonable doubt. See, there it is, reasonable doubt. Not just skeptical doubt, but reasonable doubt. Well, what is that? Well, the law will tell you what it is, but in most people's minds, that could vary. But in a court of law, it's a more controlled system and method. And so at any point in life, you see, we're really likely to be using some influence of philosophy, and the more practical, the more possible that can be. And people do it all the time just to be happy or avoid unpleasant situations or circumstances, you know. That's utilitarianism, you know. They'll put more effort into avoiding pain than they will in accomplishing a goal, which could make them happy. But that's what Mill said they should be doing. You should be moving towards happiness.
You know? You said having that retrospective?
Introspection. It's really the, you've heard it in, and the interesting thing is you can hear it again in Shakespeare, "To thine own self be true." Mm-hmm. There it is again, see?
Yeah. See, what's that's so fascinating to me, because lately I've been reading a lot of like books on mindfulness and just Buddhism and stuff like that. And what's really fascinating is that these people who wrote these books, who passed down this knowledge and teachings, are they're basically experts or masters of the mind, because they spend their time on, you know, 30 years swearing a vow of silence, or you know, they sit there and meditate all day. And none of us, all of us have busy lives, never have time to do even an hour of that throughout our days, let alone these guys. That's their job, in a sense. That is their life.
Well, they have the luxury of less distractions. Let's put it that way. We are suffering in our luxury of distractions. So we are doing it to ourselves.
And even honestly, we're not distracted. We're so used to it that we become irritable and bored and stuff. And it's fascinating to see that they all preach the same thing too when it comes to introspective and spending time in your own head and questioning your own morals and beliefs and society's morals and beliefs. It's so important in ancient cultures, yet it fades away the farther you get towards today. We're just so
unfortunately.
Unfortunately. Well, at least you're doing a good job of spreading the word, teaching some students there.
I'm doing my best. Doing my best.
So now, what do you think, as a like a whole, we kind of talked about it with basically what we just said there, but philosophy has influenced society. It kind of is its glue. It's our way of kind of it's our way of not being monkeys.
Right. Yeah. I think, to me, the largest benefit is you become more aware, as I said earlier, about patterns in the way people think. And I can't remember who said it first, but someone said, and I'm probably going to misquote this, but it's along the lines of genius is the ability to detect patterns and think along the same lines, create along the same lines. So if you can be a person who can see an idea as well as think an idea visually and verbally, if you can put those two together, you're probably on your way philosophically. But the way I think of it is this, the pre-Socratics, they talked about atomistic design to the entire universe. And this was before they even could scientifically quantify what an atom was. That didn't happen until Einstein. But yet they spoke of atomistic elements to the universe. I think it was Lucretius who wrote that poem that did that first. And so this is without all the technology we have today to look deeper and farther into things. And so to me, I kind of wonder if it's possible to imitate people like that and maybe see philosophy, not like an atom, because that's already taken, they've done it, but maybe like DNA, if you could label ideas like dominant or recessive genes and talk about dominant and recessive ideas, how has that gotten down to us over time? And have they changed for better or worse, like genetics?
Interesting. That is so interesting. So if you recognize patterns well enough and use philosophy and different methods of philosophy, without technology, you can ponder, you can get down to philosophizing that the universe is made up of atoms without even coming close to having any technology to. That's insane.
That there's something, well, it's that's why it's easier to describe that when we were on the ground in classes. Now that everything is online, it seems to be, I don't know, I haven't had the opportunity yet to, you know, go through that as much online yet, but that is hopefully that would translate online as well as it would in a PowerPoint in the classroom. But yeah, it's more about, again, we're back to the idea of what can you do with the greatest tool you have, which is your mind.
Yeah. That is so fascinating. It just finally like clicked for me the power of what that way of thinking can do. If you apply it towards, like what you said, anything, you look at a gem and it's got a million different ways you could see it. That's pretty cool. So now my last question would be, do you think we should be teaching this to younger generations? What would happen? What would the world look like if we taught it to a generation of kids?
I've been thinking about that, but there's one more thing I wanted to mention, talk about. I guess I wanted to talk about just for a moment more, kind of goes back into how everybody's involved in philosophy, because when it comes to children, not everybody is the way they once were. So let me jump into that question by stressing this. So talked about, you know, how important it was, how philosophy's done without realizing, and how influential these ideas are. I think we are all involved in this when it concerns big issues like the economy, the government, freedom, and justice. I mean, think about how many people this year pondered bigger questions when the virus struck. They probably hadn't done that in years.
Yeah.
Thinking about, okay, what if my life ends this year? What if the government melts down? What if this happens, that happens? Everybody started to become a garden philosopher, if you will. So they had to start thinking. It was like they were forced into it.
Yeah.
And so all these big changes that go on, whether it's in medicine, technology, or laws, things don't always sync up the same at the right time. Those changes can actually get ahead of real time. And by the time we've had a chance to think them through, they're already in practice, and now we're dealing with more dilemmas and more problems that we've made. So this is what I think people should do before they teach it to children. First, take the philosophers and treat them as real human beings. Every philosopher who gave us what we're studying today, they didn't come up with this stuff while they were sitting at Starbucks on their laptop getting free Wi-Fi. These folks were going through intense, personal, and usually larger uncomfortable situations. And I'll give you this example because I think this is another way people could put things together and appreciate the subject. Take, for example, the three of the biggest names in philosophy. They experienced the exact same event in three different places at three different moments. And they came to three different answers to the same question. Plato watched the city-states collapse and then came up with his idea of the Republic. St. Augustine had a front row seat when the Empire of Rome collapsed. Confucius saw the Qin dynasty melt down. And they all came up with answers to this. So it doesn't matter where you live, when you live, the scale of a problem. We've all got very human reasons to do this, to look for something bigger. And so that's kind of what leads me into the children's question you gave me. We always say we want our children's lives to be better than our own. Well, shouldn't that include giving them better ways to think and engage with ideas? I mean, Parents have to know they're modeling this stuff. Because if you go back into ancient Greece, adolescents were actually exposed to philosophy a lot earlier than today. And I think even the parents knew more philosophy then. Because if you take the term pedagogy that educators love to throw around today, it actually refers to the training of very young children. And that would usually be done at home before you sent your child off to be taught at an academy. And so the sooner you do this with kids, the sooner you're probably going to make better writers, artists, scientists, engineers, and so on. And there are institutes out there that are actually doing this for children. And really, even private schools do this to a degree. So to me, it's happening, but maybe not enough. And the last thing I'd want to say is that, you know, I think it was Bertrand Russell that said, philosophy is about asking the right questions. Well, boy, who asks more questions in life than children? And it's usually why. So they're kind of like mini philosophers. They're kind of like, they kind of come pre-packed that way. So that's kind of my big answer to your question about.
Cool. I like that answer. It makes a lot more sense too, because we gotta understand it first before we start teaching it as well.
Yeah. Why was it done before? Well, it's probably why it should be done now.
Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting conversation.
Well, thank you.
I would love to have you back on sometime. We're gonna cut it here. Sure. Yeah, but thank you for coming on. I really enjoyed this.
And, my pleasure. I did too.
Thanks. We hope to have you back on soon.
I would like that.
Cool. Stay safe, and I appreciate the great semester with you.
Thanks a lot, man. Take care.
Thanks.
Talk again. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, hit that thumbs up or like button, or even share this podcast with some friends. And make sure you subscribe to my channel and all listening platforms to stay up to date with all the new content coming out. That's The Matt Rich Podcast on all listening platforms. If you'd like to support the channel, visit my Patreon at patreon.com/TheMattRichPodcast. I love you all, and I will see you next time.